You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 472. Nobody ever changed the world by doing what everyone else was doing. Mark Cuban.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's film, B-I-Z, book.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T, chart. Well, guys, today we have on the show Trevor Hawkins and Nathan Kincaid, the creative force behind the new film Lackawanna. And what makes this film very interesting is they are the first independent film to ever sell an NFT, putting their film up as a non-fungible token. And if you've already heard my prior episode about NFTs, which is episode 471, you'll know what that is. And I wanted to bring an example on the show of someone doing it and actually being successful on it. They've raised a good amount of money by selling NFTs to their film. And there's a lot of unique ways they're also selling films, how you do it with NFTs. And I really wanted to do a deep dive into what they're doing and how they even got up there and started doing it in the first place. So if you've ever wanted to see a case study of NFTs in its early stages, in its infancy, it's kind of like being the first one on YouTube or the first video ever released on streaming or something along those lines. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Trevor Hawkins and Nathan Kincaid. I'd like to welcome to the show Trevor Hawkins and Nathan Kincaid, man. How you guys doing?
Great, man. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thanks. Awesome. I'm so happy to have you guys, man. It is, you guys came on my radar a little while ago when I saw something about NFTs fly by, and I was like, wait a minute, I've heard of these NFTs. Some guy just sold an NFT for $70 million or some craziness. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute, there's some filmmakers being involved in this stuff. I'm like, let me check out what you did. And I saw some articles that were written about you in your film. And I was just like, well, I gotta talk about that. I gotta get in there. So from the moment that we actually booked this to the moment that we're actually recording it, I, of course, have done obscene amounts of research into NFTs, Bitcoin, blockchain, and the whole ball of wax. I mean, I've seen every documentary ever made about these subjects matters. Well,
you might be more of an expert than we are at this point, then.
but
can
you're
we interview you.
But the thing is, though, but you guys are in it. Like, you guys are in the weeds on it. So, like, all I have is just knowledge, but you guys are like in the weeds doing stuff, and I want to see how it's working out for you and everything. So, before we jump into NFTs, blockchain, and all these kind of buzzwords that everyone's hearing out there, how did both of you guys get into the business?
I just picked up a camera in high school and started filming my friends skateboarding and wakeboarding. And I love the skateboarding and wakeboarding videos more than I like the actual sport. I fell in love with the art of it. And then in high school, I went to my buddy, his name's Brian Freeborn's house. And in 1 week, we watched in his parents' basement Requiem for a Dream, Donnie Darko, and A Clockwork Orange. And holy that just blew my mind. That's a heavy week.
Is that a week?
And I was just like... Yeah, in 1 week, and that was I wasn't even really that familiar with cinema at that point, and so it obviously knocked my socks off, and I've been in love with it ever since, and I've been chasing it ever since.
Wow, that's a heavy week, brother, man. That is a heavy, heavy week, man. How about you, Nathan?
Yeah, I mean, in high school, kind of similar. I was a kid. I had a camcorder in the trunk of my Pontiac Grand Am.
Nice. And, well played, sir. Shooting. Well played.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to go to college. That was like a family stipulation. But here in Missouri, there was no film program. So I was a communication major. Felt like itches weren't getting scratched, cinematic itches. So I was shooting for the athletic department. I was up on a scissor lift filming football practices. I was under the hoop shooting basketball games. And then I decided to go to film school for a master's degree. And LA's always, it's funny that we're here talking about what we're doing with NFTs from Missouri, because I've always kind of had a side eye at Los Angeles just from reading the trades. And Down and Dirty Pictures was a book that made a really big impact on me.
Yeah, great book.
Yeah, so I was like, and then I've always been a huge Coppola fan. And so I went to film school in San Francisco. Yeah. And then it was during a time when digital was really starting to take over. But at the school I was at, they were like, digital will never take over film. And so I was like, okay. So I learned film and came up in that, and which I'm grateful for, you know, in hindsight, because it makes you pre-visualize and be more prepared and all that stuff. But then after school, I didn't want to take the well-paved road to Los Angeles, so I came back to Kansas City to kind of figure it out. And it wasn't soon after that I met Trevor, and I found a kindred spirit and someone else who really was like serious about doing this. And then we just started getting in the local game, and then eventually that led to a lot of commercial work. And so we both currently make a living in this market doing commercial production. Yeah, that's what we've been doing for the last decade, basically.
And I've said it on the show a million times. I think some of the best ground you can work to get experience is commercials for film, because you work. Of course, you learn the craft, but it's the politics, man. The politics the politics of the set, how to handle clients, how to do that. It just walks right into like how to handle investors, how to handle producers. If you get into the studios, how do you handle executives and how you balance and then egos and all of that stuff. So it's a great training ground for all of that. But now tell me about your film. Now, if I pronounce it correctly, La Tawana.
Oh, you nailed it.
Thank you, sir. thank you, sir. Yeah. So tell me about your film, La Tawana.
Yeah, so La Tawana is a story about a young couple that live on a sailboat, and they're sort of, I guess, over a bit fed up with their superficial materialistic lives they've been leading. And so they sort of recreate this world for themselves out on a sailboat. And maybe because of a bit of lack of preparedness, that world comes crashing down on them. And so the whole movie is sort of a thought experiment to the viewer of, can we rewrite our own rules of modern existence, or does society operate its way for a reason? And it's sort of like idealism meets realism, kind of. It was born out of the idea that at one point I was going to leave for a few years to sail around the world with one of my friends, but that would mean I'd have to give up on my biggest hustle, my own indie film hustle, my dream of becoming a filmmaker and making films. And I'd have to give up all of that momentum. And so I had this moment where I realized that I had to stay home, and I had to give up on that like adventure dream to sort of keep my filmmaking dream alive. And so I'm just really interested in that interface there of like, can we still live authentic, unique, fulfilling lives while still sort of, you know, like doing commercial work, doing Wendy's commercials, like, to stay alive.
Bro,
which I'm grateful for.
Hey, listen, man, I started off in commercials as well, man. So I completely understand it. So it's, yeah, sometimes you're like, have you ever done tabletop?
Oh yeah.
Oh, tabletops. That's a whole other level of crazy with the client. To like, you know, can you move the cup this way? And it's not glistening properly. And you're like, what am I doing with my life? Like, why am I here? Like, it's not even a what. Like, really? But then you look at the check. You're like, okay. And you and you keep moving.
Dude,
like,
I gotta piggyback that, man. We had a moment one time, and it was slow motion, like fried onion ring bits being. And people were analyzing like which way they bounced when they hit the,
The production company that was there, they lost the account because the ketchup looked too bloody in the shot, and no one caught it, and like they did this kind of sweep across, and they're like, yeah, this director has no idea how to shoot ketchup, and you're like, wow, man, this is a thing. I don't understand.
Yeah.
This is off. Maybe I should make a left turn here.
Well, Nathan and I could go down this dark road with you for a long time.
No. This is not commercial. We're not here to talk about the horrors of working in the commercial business and how soul crushing it can be sometimes. Sometimes it's fun, but it's a bit, there's an off balance there. But so when you guys finished your movie, I'm assuming you looked at the distribution landscape and said, wow, there's only money to be made here doing the traditional distribution ways. I'm sure all these distributors are going to just give us lots and lots of money, going to be completely transparent with everything. And we should be able to recoup all of our budget and then some, so enough to be able to make another movie. Is that what the conversation was like?
Oh, yeah.
Again. I like this guy.
Trevor, you know, we've got – all these amazing offers. We're just, I guess we should just close our eyes and pick one.
You know? I know. It's like, all we see is money. Paramount. All we see is money and like complete transparency everywhere. And like, what, Netflix? Absolutely. Take two of those. Like, it's, I joke about this for everyone who's listening. This is their first episode. I joke about this because it's the saddest situation that we have as filmmakers is to deal with getting our films out there. So when you looked at the landscape, and obviously it wasn't probably what you were looking for, because last I checked, Brad Pitt doesn't star in your movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, right? So it's not yet. So it's a tough sell. I'm just looking at the movie from a trailer standpoint. It looks, by the way, stunning. It's gorgeous. It's beautifully shot. The story sounds fantastic. But in the marketplace, this is going to be – it's an interesting sell. It's an interesting sell to get it out there into the marketplace. So what made you guys that said, you know what, let's bet everything on – going down a different road.
You want to take it, Nathan?
for everyone listening and not seeing their videos, both their faces froze for a second. Smiles came up on their faces, and they just said, oh, where do you want to go? You go.
They're going to bite. Well, I mean, what we've been saying is, and everyone that's listening to this podcast is going to, I think, align with this. And that is, we're in this crazy world now where – it's easier to make a movie than it is to get anyone to see it, you know? And it's just not the same as it was. Like there aren't the same barriers to entry that there would have been to get a film camera and to get film and to put a crew together that way. So basically we've kind of had our own thematic journey as we've gone on making this movie, and we've always done everything. We've always taken every step of the way to think outside of the box. We've considered the traditional options everywhere we could, but we also step back and we're like, okay, well, because we're not a big machine, we have nimble opportunities to do things that larger budgets and entities wouldn't be able to have. So if you go all the way back to the beginning of the movie, we were entertaining some like pre-sale offers. But those were contingent on us getting, well, not Brad Pitt, but certainly name
marketable talent. Yeah.
Yeah. We would love to work with Brad, by the way, because we're all from Missouri.
Hey, Brad, if you're listening, we're all willing to work with you, sir. I know it's tough out there for you right now, Brad, but if you're willing, any one of us will work with you.
Bucket list, homie. And so basically, once we saw that, we could do a pre-sale with a certain amount of budget, with certain talent, that also then I'm putting together the schedule and I'm starting to tell Trevor, like, so we can afford like a 20-day shoot maybe. And we're thinking, man, this is our first movie. We want a little breathing room, you know? And so at a certain point we said, okay, you know, we're gonna find our own talent. And once we did that, that opened up the playbook for us. And so, for example, we decided to shoot on these lakes every season, you know, not just 3 weeks consecutive in 1 month that gave you one look. Suddenly our playbook opened up and it was like, okay, cool. Let's shoot a week in February when it's snowing. Then let's pick up in late spring. Let's do, you know, and fall and everything. And so for us, by the time we got to the to looking at the ways to get this movie out there, well, first of all, also there's the whole layer of COVID. We were so excited for film festivals. I mean, that's, as an indie filmmaker, that's your reward, kind of, you know.
Sure.
To meet people like yourself and other filmmakers and to talk about it and stuff. And so that stuff didn't happen. And then basically when the NFT possibility showed up, like this little dangly sparkly thing, well, basically Trevor and Trevor's wife, who's the co-producer with me on the film, their brother-in-law had been looking into what NFTs were. And this is like second week of March. And so he was talking to Trevor's wife about her maybe releasing this album she's been working on musically as an NFT. And then it just, the conversation evolved from there. And they spent a weekend looking into it. And then they kind of pitched it to me. And I was just like, oh, yeah, I see this, what this is. And so, and again, because we weren't, we didn't have investors that we had to get permission from. Mm-hmm. We just had to decide on our own if this is what we want to do. And it's just like, well, what do we have to lose, really?
So we've been talking about NFTs. Can you explain to the audience what is an NFT?
You can do that part, Trevor.
Okay, so the way I understand an NFT as of the last month and a half is they exist on the blockchain, and the blockchain is one irrefutable code that exists in one unit all around the world, and it exists across all types of computers that are always cross-referencing and cross-checking each other. So if anybody tries to counterfeit the blockchain, it's essentially impossible because they'll get caught. And I don't know the repercussions of what happens there.
It just can't. Yeah, I can't get it. Yeah, you just can't, because it ruins everything else afterwards. Yeah.
Sure. And so what that's done is, throughout time, if an artist were to paint a painting and then hold it in their hands, they can take it to a gallery, and a gallery can quantify that and say, this painting is worth this much because there's only one. But enter the age of digital art, where if you create a piece of digital art, whether it be a cat meme or a movie like us or an album or a digital painting, you can recreate that digitally an infinite number of times, essentially losing value to every one of the copies. There's never been an original. There technically was, but it doesn't matter to people because it's non-verifiable. And so what happens with the blockchain is since you can have one blockchain and one blockchain only, if you upload your art to the blockchain in a process called minting, then you all of a sudden have verifiable proof that cannot be broken, that that is the original piece of art that has ever existed. So if I were to make a cat meme and upload it onto the blockchain as an NFT, then that will forever be the first cat meme that there's ever been
by me.
And then the reason why that has value is just like, why does anybody care about hanging original art in their house versus just a replica? Everybody feels the value of the authenticity there. And so for the first time ever, digital art has had an authentication process of originality. And so that's why this whole thing is sort of stormed and flared up, as all these digital artists are running into this space. And we've been really lucky because we, like Nathan said, when this whole thing kind of exploded, we were standing there with the recently completed indie film in our hands, and nobody had done this with an indie film yet. And so we just kind of took the plunge. Like Nathan said, we weren't beholden to anybody. I actually mortgaged my house to make the movie. And so we own the movie outright, Nathan, wow, myself, and my wife, Corey. And so we didn't have to ask permission to anybody. And we just threw it up as an NFT. And we have a few different NFTs available. Some of them are copyright NFTs. We have a collection of those where if anybody purchases one of our copyright NFTs, they will actually become one of the shareholders of the theatrical cut of our movie and join in with decision making and profit sharing and everything that goes with owning a cut of a indie film. And then we have a world premiere NFT, which we're really excited about as well, that if anybody purchases one of these world premiere NFTs, then they're going to be the first people on the planet to watch the world premiere of this movie. Like Nathan was saying, we don't have festivals right now with COVID, and the ones that we've been accepted to have all said they're just doing a digital thing, and we haven't been stoked about that. And so this is essentially our festival run, as Nathan's been saying. And what's kind of cool about it is that forever world premieres have been a localized thing in a physical city with physical people going into physical theater. And now anyone from around the world could join our world premiere. We're also offering a couple other smaller NFTs, just entry-level things like frame grabs of the movie. And we've got a list a mile long of drops that we plan on doing here in the near future. We're excited, though, because what we found is that our specific NFTs are turning into what they're calling legacy tokens because, like you said, we were the first through the door that now – people are caring about the first NBA one, the first Elon Musk tweet, the first pretty much every type of NFT that comes to the door. And we've secured our place in history in this whole new frontier. And we're honestly, we're not experts on the blockchain. Whenever my brother-in-law told us about it, we frantically Googled what an NFT was, just like everybody else. And so we're kind of making it up as we go, but we feel really confident. And we're really stoked about where things have come so far already with it because, I mean, just in the last month or so, we've made back a fifth of our production budget. And that's just within the first month. And what's sweet about NFTs is after you sell an NFT and then subsequent purchases, like say if that buyer were to resell that to another buyer, you can set your percentage to where you would get I think the industry standard is 10%, which is what we went with. We'll get 10% of resales down the road. So as legacy tokens raise in value, we will see money coming from that down the road. And our end goal is to turn this around and be able to use this whole new marketplace and this whole new frontier to fund our next film that we've already got written and ready to go.
So legacy tokens are essentially the rookie card of the artist, essentially. So this is the Mickey Mantle rookie card, or the
But it's not just the rookie card of a player. It's kind of the rookie card of a sport.
You have a rookie card of the sport because you're the first out the gate doing something like this. But then being the one that gets that, not only that legacy token, but of Trevor's first film out there. And the way I've explained it to some people is like, imagine if, you had Quentin Tarantino's NFT for My Best Friend's Birthday, which is the unreleased first feature he ever did, or the Reservoir Dogs NFT.
Right.
And all of a sudden when Quentin blew up, that NFT would be extremely valuable. So absolutely, when you're purchasing an NFT from an artist, which is what's going on here, you're betting not only on the NFT, but you're also offering something else. And there's multiple different kinds of NFTs, which we'll talk about in a second, but you're also betting that Trevor is his next movie is going to be the Avengers, obviously. And then he wins the Oscar for the Avengers, first time ever. And then, things like that. And then all of a sudden that NFT turns into a much more valuable proposition. I know he's blushing, by the way, everyone. He's actually blushing right now. but that's the thing. If you're buying NFTs from Sundance Film Festival guys and gals, how many of those, if there was NFTs in the 90s, how much would Ed Burns, Richard Linklater, Spike Lee, you know, Steven Soderbergh, all those
videotape,
all those NFTs. What would they be worth today? You know, if there was something like that. So when I was looking into NFTs, the first thing, I just couldn't grasp it. I'm like, okay, I get it. But then it just like, oh, it's a rookie card. Got it. Absolutely. Okay. And then every movie is another season that he's playing. And maybe that movie, so let's say your next movie blows up. That's the year that you won the MVP and you won the World Series. You know, but other seasons, maybe other movies don't pop that way and they're not as valuable because of, you know, but in like in any filmmaker's career. Some movies are much more valuable than other films, depending on.
I think that's a great analogy. I haven't heard it put that way, but that's actually quite nice, I think.
I like the baseball card one. And then also you think about like Amazing Spider-Man number one. Or
same thing.
Like
comic
that.
Book. Yep. Yep. Well, it's like in comic books. As I was a comic book, I've been a comic book collector most of my life. You know, there's different issues that have more value because of what happens in the issue. So the first appearance of Venom, or the first appearance of the Green Goblin, or whatever the different things are, when Spider-Man's suit turns black, or these kind of things, these events make those issues more popular and hence more valuable. Same thing would happen with NFTs. So you already have a rookie card scenario. You have your amazing, not Amazing Spider-Man number one. You have Amazing Fantasies number 15, which is the first appearance of Spider-Man with Latawana right now. And you're also like, oh, by the way, you're also the first comic book. That's a legacy token. So that's essentially what you guys have in this thing. And then as your careers continue to grow, the value of this, not only from the point of view of being the first comic book and the first appearance of Trevor as a filmmaker and, you know, as a creator or the creative creator behind this, and forgive me if there's other creators, I'm just using you as an example, Trevor, behind this, but then the value goes up. But then there's a bit, sometimes you might have a 1941, like Spielberg did. You know, he has Jaws, Close Encounters, 1941. And then all of a sudden, 1941 might not be as valuable. But then Raiders of the Lost Ark came up, and then that NFT is going to explode as well. So that's the kind of – that's the way I see it in my head, and that's the only way I can make any sense of it all. But it's extremely exciting potential, and I feel that no one's really figured it out yet. No one. Everyone's still trying to figure it out literally by the day. I've been having conversations with – distribution guys about figuring it out. They're all trying to figure out how to crack the nut. They all know something's cool here and they all know it's the future. But I was just thinking, this is a no-brainer for like Disney. This is a no-brainer for like, you know, you're going to buy the Avengers.
I'm sure
they're going to be in an Avengers, you know, or the next Black Panther. Can you imagine an NFT for Black Panther? You know, after Chadwick unfortunately passed, like the value of that's like, oh my God, how much? I mean, and even before his passing, just the explosion of what that movie was. Imagine if there was an NFT for that. Or I think the NBA guys have been doing it the best, the Top Shot guys. I mean,
we've been fortunate enough to talk to some like development companies in the NFT world right now, and they're talking exactly like you. The actual people writing the code and developing this world right now are saying to themselves that we don't know where this is going to go. We don't know if we're going to be the ones. Right now, all these tech companies are rushing in like the gold rush of 19,049, whatever year that was, 1490, whatever.
Right.
But right now, no one knows what's going to happen. It's a brave new world, and we're lucky enough to be the first ones out of the gate in the entire film industry.
That's insane, man. That's absolutely insane. Now with NFT, so you have, there's different kinds of NFTs. So you actually are selling basically points, essentially. You're selling like points of the film through distribution. And is it only for the theatrical run or is it for all of the distribution of your film? Because I know Kevin Smith is releasing his next movie and giving, like literally just selling and auctioning off his entire distribution rights to his film. So what is yours?
So yeah, we have a few different types of NFTs, and just how we kind of took a note from when we were researching, we kind of took a note from Kings of Leon when they released their album, and Grimes and a few other folks when they released their music. You also get these bonus things with them. And so we kind of took a note from their style. And in addition to the NFT itself, the NFT is literally only a chunk of code on the blockchain. So if you buy a normal NFT, that's really all you're getting. You don't own the copyright to the piece of art. You don't own copyright to anything else. But with us, if you buy one of our copyright NFTs, then the bonus you get with that is an actual share of the theatrical cut of the movie. And so it's, you would own that cut of the film. So wherever that theatrical cut goes off and lives in the world, you would own a part of that and own, be entitled to any profits to that. The counterintuitive part is that the value of what you're purchasing in the NFT is really just the NFT itself. Because as everybody knows, becoming an investor and owner in an indie film has never been a get rich quick scheme. And,
really quickly, how do you make $1 million in the film industry?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You start with a billion.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. And so the day, if and when Lotawana turns a profit, then absolutely all of our shareholders who have purchased these NFTs will be entitled to that. But really the value and the cool piece of this whole bit is just owning that NFT itself. And then, and like I said, in the other collection that we've got is the world premiere. The bonus you get with that world premiere NFT is that you'll be the first person to ever watch that movie in the public world premiere of Lotawana. So that's kind of like a ticket stub. The NFT is really the ticket stub. And along with that ticket stub, you get to go to the event.
Now, do you actually, all right, so you don't actually put the entire movie up on OpenSea, which is the platform that you guys chose to use. It's not like the whole movie is up there somewhere for someone to watch. You're actually just selling rights at this point. So you're selling rights or access to the film in one way, shape, or form. Like, and because you're buying it on the blockchain or you're buying an NFT, it's there and it's yours and you can't get rid of it and it's done. But there's other ways of going about it. So you're selling distribution, basically selling points. To points and event, like, you know, points, basically points and world premiere. So you're selling like a couple of different things, but you could also sell it as an art piece. So you could say there is 100 limited edition NFTs of Lotawana as an art piece that you can sell. And if you, and there's only going to be 100 ever. So they're like limited edition prints of the film. And there's only 100 of them. So if you had, again, going back to that analogy, El Mariachi, the only one of your number, you know, you have one of 100 El Mariachi NFTs, what would that be worth today? So that's another possibility in selling it more as an artwork thing. But there's other, the other possibility of selling distribution rights. And also there's another possibility of raising funds for your film. So crowdsourcing and crowdfunding through it as well. You've heard of that as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've been thinking about that route for a long time. And yeah, it's a good point when you're saying about making it an art piece. You know, you think of like certain, say, a Criterion Collection DVD that has only a certain run. And we thought about all that. So you have to remember when we were getting this thing minted on March 16th, you know, and we're trying to move fast because we don't know who else is out there trying to do this, right? So you're really quickly trying to decide what we want to do. And you know, we quickly decided that we wanted to put this real world value on it as well. But we then saw an opportunity. And this is where it gets exciting because this is an experiment as well. So when we made the copyright NFT, that opens up this kind of thought process. This, you know, you've opened a new organic road of thinking here. And so now we're like, okay, so what happens when we get an offer for distribution? Do we then, and where we're getting now and working with lawyers on making real is like, you know, then do those copyright NFT holders get, go to a password protected site and they get to see the deal points and they get to vote?
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Right. And so I know I went to film school. I know there's a lot of film school people out there that don't get to be involved in these kind of conversations and they'd love to be, you know, it's exciting. So
it is exciting, yeah. But also I think you're, and this is again, being the first one through the door, you're the one that gets shot or first one over the hill, you get the arrows in your back. The thing is that you're living in the NFT and the rights are in the NFT, are in the NFT, but you're still dealing in the real world and like the legacy world of distribution and the legacy world of how money is made and everything like that. If the entire system was on blockchain, if everything worked on blockchain, then it would be all automatic. It'd be an automatic payment system. So you wouldn't even have to worry about it. We'd be doing smart contracts, essentially.
Well, we have a digital strategist who actually probably should be on this call with us, but he's much more knowledgeable about this whole space. And he's telling us about platforms that already exist that you can just sort of throw Lotawana as a project onto and then divvy up all this stuff. We actually have plans of releasing the film Lotawana properly to the entire world to view later this year, like fall, winter time. And as Nathan said in the beginning, we had offers that we weren't stoked about for pre-sales and initial financing, and then we decided to go our own route. We had our own production struggles that those are stories all in themselves that we had to overcome. And then after the movie's completed, we had distribution offers that we weren't that stoked about as well.
Can you tell me what those were? I love hearing these fantastic offers.
Well, hey, without names.
Without name dropping
companies, it was just sort of everything you would expect for an indie film. We had a handful of distributors that were like, yeah, we'll throw you up on all these digital platforms and then we expect you to see this much money, and they give us these breakdowns of all this stuff. And then we looked at their slate of films that they're currently representing, and maybe they'd have one or two gems in there, but for the large part, they were like, we called them like spray and pray distributors, where they just like throw a million movies into
shotgun distributors. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so we put too much time and too much work and too much blood, sweat, and tears into this film to just settle for something like that. And we're proud of the film that we made. And so it felt a little bit like settling, that we kind of knew that we wouldn't get a lot out of it. And so that's when this whole NFT thing came along and we didn't have something we were super stoked about on the table, we said, what the hell? Why not? And it's paid off for us, because we're getting to talk to you, and how many indie films out there would have loved to have conversations. I mean, we've talked to IndieWire and Screen Rant and 30 others, or maybe not 30, maybe like 15 others or something like that. Right, and like so many indie films would just love that opportunity. And like I said, we're already starting to make money back, so we feel like it's been a success so far. And looking forward to the way we release the movie publicly to the world. We've got some ideas that we're really excited about that is even going to sort of try to transform that space a little bit as well, like do something that not everybody's doing and actually getting eyeballs from around the world to watch the movie.
That's awesome, man. It's such an exciting thing. And one thing that we kind of talked about, but I want everyone listening to understand, is that with NFTs, that 10% that you're talking about that you've set in the NFT, that, you know, if someone resells it, that's revolutionary for an artist. That's an absolutely revolutionary idea, because if Van Gogh paints a Van Gogh and gives it to a gallery and the gallery pays $500 for it, then Van Gogh dies and everyone thinks that he's a millionaire. Or if he doesn't die, he's still alive and everyone thinks, oh my God, this guy's amazing. They could go off and sell that for $60 million and the artist gets nothing. Not a cent. But with NFTs, the artist continues to generate revenue with every resale. So if the artist becomes more popular, if the artist becomes more expensive, the artist is continuously getting a passive revenue stream for the rest of his life. And I'm not even sure if it continues to go on and on, you know, for eternity, essentially. Yeah.
Absolutely right. Just how Macklemore and Sturgill Simpson, when they first started releasing their own music, they kept it. They didn't want to go through the label system because of how many people had their hands in the honeypot. And they decided, hey, you know what, this new digital world and new emerging technologies, why don't we just do it ourselves this way? And they're better off for it. And so now that the film industry is kind of taking a note from the music industry in a lot of different ways, we're really kind of letting ourselves be the guinea pigs for all these new avenues of the film industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty brave what you guys are doing. I mean, because I mean, looking at the film, I don't know what your budget was, but looking at the film, it doesn't look like it was done for $5. I mean, it looks like it cost a minute. I mean, it cost a bit to make. So, and you refinanced your house and got the money, which I've yelled from the top of the mountain in this podcast. Don't ever refinance your house to budget an independent film. I've said it a million times because it's a, you'd be the first to explain. It's a risk. But it's, yeah. Is it a risk that you're willing to take? So, you know, hopefully I don't think that it's going to – you have – I say that because you also have a career. You have revenue coming in. But I've seen filmmakers who do that, and they're hoping and praying that this is the only revenue that's going to keep their family alive. And I've seen I've seen divorces. I've seen everything. I mean, because that's just stupid. But you're taking a calculated risk, so it's okay. I will I will accept. not that you need my acceptance, but I just want everyone to know that, yes, that makes that we'll take it. It makes all the sense in the world. Now, one other thing that you were doing with NFTs is you started putting out stills from your film as, I'm assuming, art pieces. Those are being treated as art pieces?
Yeah. So each still that we put out 20 so far. When we first listed it, they're about $5 a pop, but Ethereum's gone up a little bit, so they might be around 10 now. I don't know.
10, 12. Those are
Yeah, sure. And those are just meant to be just little art pieces, entry-level things that if people are excited about what we're doing, they can jump in and buy some of those as well. Over half of them have already been bought. There's only 9 of them left. So,
and you're only doing one at a time. There's only one NFT per still.
Exactly. So, and we released 20 stills from the movie that we're stoked about, and I think 11 of them have sold. So, and I'm not even sure if anybody's even relisted them for sale yet. So those are digital art piece collectibles that people are already owning, and they will always and forever be the NFT owners of that. And there'll never be any more. Those are sort of like one-off things.
That's so awesome. Like, I can't believe that you've actually, that's like, I don't mean to say, I'm like, I can't believe that's working. Like, like I can't believe it, but it makes sense. I mean, if you're into this and if you're really excited about doing it, it makes all the sense in the world. And you are, it's just such a, everyone listening, you have to understand the potential here is massive for the right project, for people who know what they're doing, how they do it. It's not going to be perfect for everybody. But it's another potential revenue stream. Even if you go traditionally, you can still do NFTs. And I'm already hearing the distributors are adding that into the contracts now. I'm like, yes, this includes NFTs. You can't, we own everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The music industry is being flipped upside down right now in real time from this. And there's music companies out there that are trying to be the next big Spotify for the blockchain world. And everything's changing in real time because it's sort of a user generated space where you can be the owners of all of your content is where Spotify has been. I don't really have a dog in this race, but Spotify rips off musicians.
Usually. Oh, absolutely. Like, absolutely.
Yeah. They don't pay what they should be paying for all of their plays, and artists are getting tired of that. And so entered blockchain and all these new technologies, and people are running over there, and just like streaming upset the world of like CDs and traditional music purchasing. Now the blockchain is upsetting the existing streaming paradigm, and the film industry forever has had an existing physical DVD, VHS paradigm that got disrupted by streaming. And now the film industry will probably take a note from the music industry as it usually does. And the blockchain and all of these new interfaces could be next. And like I said, we just happen to be the first out of the gate.
I mean, yeah, like with NBA Top Shots, I mean, those guys jumped on so quickly and they're doing so well with those NFTs. I mean, and they're the first kind of major organization to really take it seriously. But it was just a no brainer. Like it's a sports card, but you're buying highlights. You know, you're buying, imagine if you're buying a Michael Jordan highlight, like you own that highlight. Like that's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool idea. So if you owned El Mariachi, you know, as an art piece, pretty cool bragging rights, man. I got to say, like, you know, like, absolutely. And like people listening, like I got Lotawana's, you know, NFT. Like I bought the first independent film ever put out on NFT. That's bragging rights. And that's the same reason why you buy an original and put it up on the wall as opposed to buying a poster.
100%.
Right. Now you also chose, I was going to ask you about, is it gassing or
gas fees?
Gas fees, yeah. So explain to the people, like if OpenSea is the platform you're using, they're arguably one of the biggest platforms for NFTs, right? Yeah. So explain what a gas fee is and what was your gas fee to put this stuff up, if you don't mind me asking.
OpenSea operates a little differently than some of the other platforms you can mint NFTs on. And you only pay your gas fees and percentage to the platform, which is OpenSea, once your NFT sells. So you can list 100 or 1,000 NFTs and you don't pay a dime until they start selling. And then they just take a percentage of that. And what gas fees are, it costs money and human hours to keep to make the blockchain exist and keep going. And gas fees, all those are, is money going into the honeypot of developers that keep this thing running. So nobody's really making a ton. From what I understand, I'm not an expert on the blockchain, but these are literally just like your taxes that you have to pay to keep the roads going.
And for people, so from my understanding of the blockchain, in order for every transaction that goes into the blockchain, and by the way, there are multiple blockchains. So everyone thinking that there's just not the one blockchain. There's multiple different blockchains by, you know, Ethereum is one. Bitcoin runs on another blockchain, but that's crypto. And we'll get to crypto in a minute. Flow and there's a bunch of different blockchains. And then there's now people building blockchains internally for companies. Blockchain is a concept. But Ethereum is arguably the biggest, most well-known blockchain to do other to tack on other businesses and platforms and things on. So it's like a highway that they've put on where you could put you can establish businesses and houses and things like that. So from my understanding with blockchain, hold on, I just lost my train of thought because this is tough, man. This is rough stuff, blockchain.
Well, and you're getting into the point where you're going to start schooling us. We might be learning some facts from you here real quick. We're not experts on.
Okay. So blockchain. Okay. Now it just came back to me. So blockchain, every time there's a transaction, it needs to be verified. And by the people who verify it are miners, people outside that are all around the world trying to break down the complicated math, calculations to verify that. That thing and put it into the blockchain. And there's so many transactions that go into one block before it goes back on the chain. And this is all being done completely decentralized without anyone. Those gas fees, because, and the way why miners do that is because they get paid. And how do they get paid is generally with crypto. So if they're on the Ethereum, they get a little bit of Ethereum, crypto per transaction that they break. And then everyone is racing to be the first to break that or to calculate that with their computing power. So they get the money. So there's a thousand people trying to, millions of people trying to be the first to do the math. That's why you need bigger and bigger computers, faster and faster internet, more and more power. And that's how this whole thing goes. So with Bitcoin, which we'll talk about in a second, is crypto, which is it's an actual currency. Every transaction that happens on that is a bit slower because it's getting tougher and tougher to break these codes because there's a limited amount of Bitcoin ever that's going to be mined. Where Ethereum, there is not. Ethereum goes on and on and on. It was built like that because it's not arguably wasn't supposed to be a cryptocurrency. It was supposed to be a platform where people can do that. But now Ethereum is exploding. As of this recording, I mean, it's gone up like 25% in the last week or two. But that's the world of crypto. Now, how much do you guys know about crypto? And can you talk about cryptocurrencies a little bit and how that whole works?
I'll put it this way. I feel like everything you just said, we've heard from Tucker, our digital strategist, who's on our Lotawana team. And I feel like last time it was explained, my eyes kind of glazed over a bit and I exited the room somehow in my brain. Sure. I feel like I did that again a little bit right there. So I think you've reached the end of our blockchain knowledge.
Nathan, you've been very quiet, Nathan.
Yeah.
Tucker, somebody get Tucker on the phone.
Nathan and I are filmmakers from the beginning, and that's where our heart and our passion is. We're not experts on this stuff.
No worries. I wanted to get to that point, and we've reached that point, and that's fantastic, and I'm glad we've got to that point. But it's the crazy artists that are the ones who make this stuff possible, man. It's pretty remarkable. Now,
I'll just throw in there real quick, man. If you're an indie filmmaker, I mean, at some point you're an entrepreneur as well, like you're always looking for a way to just get it done, and like your hat says, you're always hustling, you know, you're trying to find a way. And so, you know, this was a way that presented itself to us, and we took it.
And basically you because I feel that an independent film that has maybe a bigger star involved or a bigger, you know, no offense, more marketable director or something else that can bring an audience, someone who has an existing audience, whether that be a YouTuber, a podcaster, or like an Ed Burns or Spike Lee or someone who has an existing audience out there. I feel that it's going to be a lot easier for them to generate revenue because they have an existing audience. So that's why I still found this so fascinating with you guys, because I'm like, well, there's no stars in it. This is his first film. So you're generating this from basically all the press that you've been getting about this, because you guys are the first one through the door and people are like, this is cool. And now this is new, and you're generating revenue from this, which is honestly ingenious.
Oh, well, thanks.
I've seen everything, bro. I've seen all about indie. I've seen every tactic on how to hustle some money for an independent film. That's why I reached out to you guys. So I was like, oh, no, I gotta get these guys on the phone.
Yeah, I mean, we're never in a million years would we have thought this is what a majority of our conversations would be about when Lotawana started getting attention. And we're actually really excited. We believe in the film itself, and we're really excited to have conversations about the actual movie whenever we do release it later this year.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll take all of it we can get right now. It's just we're so lucky that we even found ourselves in a situation.
Right,
Alex,
place.
You can
right
see time. So many examples in the past, though. Like even when Morgan Spurlock did Super Size Me, they got these like fat Ronald McDonald dolls and were handing them out at Sundance. Mm-hmm. And that got people to see the movie. And then they said, oh, that's a good movie. So, you know, we're not just a gimmick, but, you know, again, this market is so oversaturated. If you can find a way or think of a way to get through the fray, then if you're really an indie filmmaker, you have to think of something. You got to find a way.
Oh, there's no question about it, man. I mean, that's the thing. You've got a quality product, man. Look, if I would have seen the movie, honestly, I'll be straight up with you guys. I read the stories and I read the articles, but I checked the trailer out, and when I looked at the trailer, if it was like some sort of garbage thing shot on like, you know, a VHS camera or some stuff, and if it would have been like that, I would be like, nah, I can't have him on the show. There's a quality product here. I see so much, man. I talk to independent filmmakers on a daily basis. I'm sent everything every day. So I see so much stuff coming through. So when anything like this comes through in front of my radar, I can see quality. So I'm like, okay, these are filmmakers. They know the craft. They can put something together that looks really good. So I knew there was quality there, but trust me, man, if this was like a garbage thing, I would have not had you guys on the show. I'd be like, look, I'll find another way to talk about NFTs, but there's a quality movie here. So it's not a gimmick, because that would have been a gimmick. Like, you know, if a trauma film does this, which I'm sure Lloyd will be doing this any moment now. But if like a, you know, like a trauma film makes something like this, which are those like Toxic Avenger films, which he should, because they're going to sell out. but a trauma-esque film that didn't have the cachet that trauma does, I would have been like, so much. But this is quality, man. From the poster to the trailer to the website. No, you guys have a solid presentation of a film. And I don't take that very lightly, because most independent films have absolutely no idea how to present themselves, how to market themselves, how to get themselves out there. So that's another reason why I wanted to get you guys on the show.
Well, that means a lot, man, especially since you live and breathe this world. that means a lot. That's huge. It's Nathan and I have been hitting our heads together for long enough now, because, I mean, we are proud of the film we made. And, I mean, we'll see what the world thinks of it. We're really excited to hear the goods with the bads. But, I mean, we're not famous. Nathan and I aren't famous. Our actor and actress aren't famous. And we did make a drama that is pretty not by the books. And when we were starting out, we thought we wanted to do something different. But really what happens is a double-edged sword, where you kind of get penalized when you're in our situation because we're not famous. If we were famous doing something different, people would eat it up instantly. Or if we had a top, like an A-list star in our movie, then people go to see it in a heartbeat. But since we don't have any of that stuff along with the ride, we've got to come up with something crazy like NFTs just to get people to even look at it.
Right. No, absolutely. And that's the problem with the marketplace today. Like, and you've honestly, Nathan, you said it so beautifully at the beginning of this conversation. It's like, there is no barrier to entry to make a movie now. Anyone can make a feature film. You just cobble together basic understanding of how to craft a film. It's not hard to do. I mean, look, it is. It's hard to craft a good film. We all know that. But the technical aspects of making it, it's not, the cost is not there anymore. Like you could, like my last couple movies I made for under 10 grand each, and they were sold around the world and gone on Hulu and all this kind of stuff. But those were those kind of stories, those kind of movies. But now it's about getting it seen. So, and what are film schools still teaching? They're still teaching you how to make a movie.
I don't know, but yeah, I mean, now all the information I got worth $50,000 in debt, you can find online. So,
listen, I was $20,000 in debt. I graduated in 90, okay, something 90 something. Yeah. So, and I the best two things I learned in film school is how to wrap cable. And because that's an art form, how to wrap cable properly and how to make a good cup of coffee. And that got me my first few jobs. That's other than that, my post teacher said they'll never edit broadcast quality on a computer ever. That's what he said. I remember that so clearly in my head. I was like, wow. Okay. And I learned on film too. I learned on film and on online systems like the CMX 3600. I know you guys are younger. You're much younger than me. So I'm like, I'm probably talking gibberish to you, but like the online tape to tape and all that kind of stuff is what I learned on. And the first Avid I jumped on was when it was called Media Composer. And it was like 260 by 260 or some shit. Like it was like resolution was horrible.
Casablanca type stuff.
No, when we were Casablanca,
we used to have this editing machine in my broadcasting class in high school called a Casablanca, and it was like a VHS to VHS editing machine. I don't even know how it worked.
Yeah, we had that too. That was one of the original like non-linear editing systems. But then I had that in high school, and then I went to undergrad, then I went to grad, and they still had flatbeds in the basement.
Yeah.
And they were like cutting for real, for real. And then the digital technology was, I remember like things like P2 cards and like the media just kept changing every other year. And it was like, I was like, man, I don't want to spend my time trying to keep up with what the fastest memory card is. Like, so I just went all in on the film and studying the classics and studying the industry and stuff like that. That wouldn't change, you know?
The lenses change so fast. The cameras change. So like now, you know, now like 8K or what is it? 10K or 12K. It's obscene what's going on right now. And it's like when I'm ready to shoot something, I'll look. I'm like, all right, what's going on? What do we got? All right, we'll pick that. And the only thing you should invest in ever is lenses, because that doesn't change. You still need good glass, no matter what the sensor is behind it. I mean, all you need is glass. And I love vintage personally. I love the nice vintage glass. And I'll geek out for you guys if you're into glass. My last film I shot with a Canoptic 5.8. Wide is the little brother to the 9.8, which Kubrick shot Clockwork Orange and Shining with, all those wide shots that they don't fisheye.
Wow.
I put it on the 16 millimeter sensor of the Blackmagic Pocket, the first Blackmagic Pocket, and I shot a movie with it. It was great. It's fantastic.
Wow. I'm a little jealous of that. I shot Lotawana on, it was self-financed, self-shot everything, and all we could afford was Canon L series glass on the EF mount, and that's what we shot Auto One on.
Dude, all my stuff's on the EF mount. EF mount or a Micro Four Thirds. Oh yeah, it's fine, dude. It's fine. I shot my last two features were on the Sigma 18-35 portrait lens, which is a fantastic lens. It looks gorgeous, and it's fine, dude. It's fine. People get all caught up with that stuff. And at the end of the day, imagine this conversation we're having right now, right? And then when there's arguments in production, like, no, we need this camera, we need this lens, we need this. But when it's done, they're like, now what? Now where do I go?
I've got a sculptor friend of mine who says it so well. He says that the best painters, the best sculptors in the world can break a twig off of a tree and make a better piece than everybody that's got all the finest toolkits available. And that's kind of how I feel with cameras as well. I don't keep up. I'm a DP as well. I shot a lot of one and I do commercial stuff, and I don't keep up minute to minute like you were saying, because I feel like it's more about the artistry of what you put in front of the lens. You got to know what the lenses do, but yeah.
At a certain point, you're just like, do I need 55K? Like, I don't need a 55K resolution camera, yeah. Which we're going to go there eventually. At a certain point, you're like, how much more do
you're
going to
broadcast it against the surface of the moon, because that's like, the kind of surface you're going to need for all that.
Yeah. I mean, so I want to get your opinion, guys. What do you think the future revenue potentials are with NFTs and independent films? Do you think that is going to become a mainstay? Do you think it's going to be become an oversaturated marketplace again, just like crowdfunding was? Because when crowdfunding showed up, the first few films that crowdfunded did extremely well, but then everyone just got burnt out on it. So do you feel that the NFTs are going to go the same route?
That's a great question, man. And that's the one that everybody's wanting to know right now, because sure, I would believe that some of the prices of some of the NFTs that have been sold for those astronomical numbers are a bit inflated. But I do believe that this is a new frontier that's here to stay. Like I said, it legitimizes digital art for the first time in history. And this, people aren't going to run away from that. This is a new frontier. Maybe things will get more valuable. Like if you get in early, maybe you'll be one of those folks that things just raise in value, which is we've already seen happening with us in just the short amount of time. But yeah, maybe eventually the digital art space is going to get so flooded that it's not a we never even thought of it as a get rich quick scheme. We were mainly just looking to get Lotawana out into the world, and this seemed like a great way to do it. And if we could, the end goal would be to fund our next film, like if we raise enough money to make a movie number two that's sitting on the table ready to go. That's the dream right there. And I don't know. I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I bet I could see a lot of folks running to the space, but it's still so green, and it'll be green for a while.
It will be.
I don't know.
How about you, Nathan?
It solves some problems, but it doesn't solve all the problems. And there's still a market saturation problem with film content. There's too much content out there. And I don't know where you're, you know, I'm not advocating for gatekeepers, because because that can be frustrating at times, and that can be politicized and monopolized, it's tough. It's like there's a way here. There's a revenue model here that exists and that we're gonna help find, but it still doesn't solve the problem of, well, what happens when you have more films being made than people can watch? You know what I mean? That's a big problem to me. And you know what? I don't know. I think maybe people need to be a little harsher in some sense. It's like, you know, just because you can make a film doesn't mean that
you should.
It's worthy of people watching it, or that you should. Yeah.
Look, it's the same thing that happened, and I saw this happen. It's when editing systems became affordable and everyone had a Final Cut. When Final Cut showed up and started disrupting Avid, because when Avid was around, it would cost $50,000 minimum to get into a digital editing system. But then at Final Cut showed up, and like, you know, maybe for $3,000-$4,000, you're up and running as an editor. And then all of a sudden, my rate from $50 an hour, $75 an hour as an editor, a freelance editor, had to drop down to 25 or 30 because I had 500 other Yahoos who had no idea how to edit anything, but they've completely saturated the marketplace. And then I'm like, I'm competing with a guy who just got out of film school who has barely any understanding, but he says he'll do it for 20. And the producer's such an idiot that he goes, sure, I'm going to pay this guy. Obviously, the money makes more sense. But then after he screwed it up, they'd usually come to me anyway. They're like, oh, this guy screwed it up. Can you do it? But that was the problem. So it's like, it's great that everyone has access to this stuff, but it's the solution and the problem all at the same time, because now it opens up opportunities for people who would have never had opportunities to do it. And then, but it also diminishes opportunities for filmmakers who should get it. And I've had that conversation with some of the guests I've had on the show. Like, I talked to Edward Burns, and not to be a douchey guy who drops names, but when I was talking to Ed Burns about it, I go, do you think Brothers McMullen would make it today? And he's like, probably not. Do you think Clerks would make it today? Do you think El Mariachi would be seen, or Slacker?
Right. But see, back then, those guys, you know, Kevin Smith and Edward Burns and like even Christopher Nolan with some of his early movies, they had a production barrier to entry that they really had to want it. They really had to have the dream and the passion, and they found a way to get it done. So then they broke through to this space where there weren't as many. And so, you know, that's what sucks now is that your barrier to entry or your gatekeepers are the distributors, but you have this whole tier of them that are letting everything through that.
Right.
I don't know. How do you separate the wheat from the chaff? How does the cream rise to the top today?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because there's distributors out there, like you were saying, the throw everything against the wall and see what sticks distributor. They're bringing they're hustling all these kids in, or these guys in, and gals who are putting these movies in, and they're like, oh, I can make a quick $5,000 off that, and the filmmaker will never see a dime ever. I'll make a quick $5,000. So if I can get 10 of those, well, that's $50,000 this month. And the way I structure the deals is I never have to pay the filmmaker. And after that, if it makes any money, whatever, but it probably won't. And they have so much content and so many films that it's a tough nut to crack, brothers. I mean, this is a tough nut to crack.
Maybe it's tastemakers. Maybe it's going back to the '70s when you had a Pauline Kael or something like that.
Or Roger Ebert.
Yeah, exactly. Roger was doing an amazing job. You know, so maybe it's Alex Ferrari. He's got to get in there and tell us what to watch. You know?
Yeah, I'm not that guy. But the point is though that there has to be something, and there are. I mean, look, Criterion Collection does a fantastic job, you know, and A24 does a fantastic job. But look at A24 slate. They do one movie a month, if that, a year. They're the Sundance of distribution at this point. You know, if you're lucky enough to get picked up by A24, you know you're going to get seen. And people are now watching an A24 film because it's A24. You know, it was like Miramax back in the day. Like, oh, Miramax released it. Must be pretty decent if that's being released. I don't know if that world exists anymore, man. I just don't. I think it's just too many streaming services, too many options. I think the next frontier for filmmakers is not only to be able to make a good movie, but you need an audience. You need an audience that follows you from film to film. And that is the next frontier, because filmmakers who are successful are the ones who cultivate audiences and then also figure out how to generate revenue from multiple revenue streams, which is what I wrote my book and all that stuff about being a film entrepreneur, about creating multiple revenue streams. And NFTs are such a great alternative revenue stream that could be potential. And again, you could arguably crowdfund your movie on NFT, sell distribution rights on an NFT, and also sell art pieces on NFTs. And those are three revenue streams that are completely outside the system. Completely outside the system to make your movie.
Absolutely. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to be the case study that can recoup our production costs and turn that around and start funding the next film in real time. That's our end goal with this whole space in the NFT world.
That's awesome, man. Well, I'm going to ask you a few questions, guys. I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
I know. You want to go first? I know what I would say.
Go for it.
Love what you do, because to me, there's a big difference between wanting to make good movies and wanting to be the person that's the filmmaker. There's an artist there on one side of it, and then there's kind of like a character type on the other side. And I've, in my own personal career, I've never really said this publicly anywhere, so I hope this isn't offensive to anybody, but I've met people that I can tell they don't really care what the movie is they're making. They just want to be the filmmaker. They want to be the person in the chair. They want to be they just want to be that person. And I think that the real value that anybody's going to get out of this career, this industry, is going to be what they create at the end of the day. My wife is a musician, and she's so self-conscious about, oh, what if nobody likes this album when it's getting ready to come out? And I'm like, I don't care if nobody ever hears this album except you and I, because at the end of the day, when you're 70 years old, all that matters is how you feel about that album. Her entry level to play the game of writing music is a lot lower than making a film.
Yeah.
That's why we all have to play this that's why we all got to have our own indie film hustle, because you need an army to make a movie. You actually have to raise a lot of damn money to make a movie. And so we have a little bit different rules there, where we have to go inside the industry enough to make it work for ourselves to even be able to make our art, which is kind of infuriating at times. But that's why I say the biggest piece of advice is love your art, love what you do. Because at the end of the day, when you're dying, that's all you're going to have is, am I proud of the pieces that I made, or did I just make schlocky things to get attention?
Oh, no. Before Nathan, I want to just piggyback on this, what you just said. There's so many filmmakers, and I've met them, who want to play the part of the filmmaker. He wants to be, or she wants to be, the rock star director. They want to be Tarantino. Let's just call it what it is. They all want to be Tarantino. They all want to sit in the chair and tell people what to do and walk the red carpet. They're red carpet filmmakers. They're not real filmmakers. They're red carpet filmmakers. They just want to take the pictures and, you know, live the lifestyle, but they don't actually want to do the work. And those guys and gals get weeded out. I've been around a little longer than both of you guys. I've seen it. It happens. The business will weed those guys because they don't last. They can't. It's too hard. This is too hard of a thing to do. You could fake your way to a certain extent, but after a certain while, if you don't got the goods, I don't care if your last name is Spielberg, it ain't going to help.
Right, right.
Nathan?
Yeah. Well, and I'll say something different, because I actually was going to say something quite similar to that. It was basically make sure this is really what you want to do, because it is so hard. So something else beyond that, it's probably something people have heard before, but it's like, if you really are committed to this and you really want to do it, then study the history, study the craft, look at who came before you, and yes, change the game, but, you know the groundwork that got you here. And I understand people, they watch Citizen Kane and they're like, okay, you know, I don't get it. I've seen that before. Yeah, but nobody saw it before then. You know what I mean? And so it's like knowing the evolution of this medium, and not going into things like 3D or, you know, a surround screen or something like that. No, that's fine or whatever. But really the medium of cinema and the evolution of juxtaposition and just the craft. Like, if you're going to get into this, do something cool so the rest of us that are also trying to do this can be inspired too. Like, my favorite stories are like how after Nolan made Memento, he still couldn't get a good deal, and Soderbergh stuck his neck out for Christopher Nolan and was like, yo, you should really use these, you know. I love that kind of stuff. So that would be my just know the craft, know the other artists that came before you and that are in the game, and do something different, do something awesome.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Trust your team. That was a big one for me. Whenever I was always a one-man show, and then Lotawana came on, and when we'd made Lotawana, I had a crew of 10, and I was just so in the mindset of I had to do everything, and Nathan was constantly reminding me, no, delegate it, man. Let me do this. Let Corey do that. Like, that was a big lesson for me to learn. And then most recently, the lesson I just learned was lean into yourself, which is a weird thing to say, because when I wrote Lotawana, it was kind of a love letter to Terrence Malick movies. And I live in a rural lake town. I'm at the real life Lake Lotawana right now. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that that would be something viable to be appealing to, like, the rural lake town, the rural America vibe would be that appealing to a lot of people in the film industry. But lately the script I've just written leans into it 100%. And I feel like I'm learning right now in real time to trust my own unique experience and lean into that more instead of what I think other people want to see.
Yeah. Well, and this is why we work together, is because what I was going to say was, you know, the lesson I had to learn was you can't do it alone. Now, I learned that, you know, a long time ago, but when you are, you know, a teenager and you're young 20s and you're full of ego and you're trying to muster up all the power to be a filmmaker, like, it's going to take a team, you know? So looking for those other people that you vibe with, that you can create with. Like, that's so important. Always keeping an eye out for those people.
And yeah, lifetime partners you can trust.
It's amen, guys. I mean, if you can find people, that's why, like, Ron Howard and Clint Eastwood, they work with the same crew for the last 30 years. Like, they, this is like, Ron Howard won't shoot a movie until his first AD is available. Like, he just, like, this is the guy. Like, I don't have to worry about anything. I know it's going to get taken care of. See, I do the same thing. I have a group of friends of mine and people I collaborate with all the time. I'm like, I just know I don't have to worry about that when I have them on it. It's so valuable, so valuable. And three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, you want to go first, Nathan?
Oh, man. I'll try to go quick without thinking too much. Trainspotting, nice. Baraka, and nice. The Godfather.
Nice.
Sure. So, ooh, cliche, the last one, but I mean that.
Bro, everybody.
I really do.
And I'm gonna argue that it's Godfather 1 and 2. Just put them together. It's fine.
Sure.
Yeah, it's fine.
He's for real. He just had a daughter, and we got him a Godfather onesie for his daughter.
Solid.
So for me, it's easy because I keep a revolving top 50 movies of all time.
Wow.
Of my favorite movies of all time lists. And so when I fall in love with the new movie, it's heartbreaking to throw one of my top 50 off just to keep my –
It's a different level. That's a different level of geek, man. I appreciate that. That's a completely devil. Like, I mean, the geek. I mean, and this is a guy who has a life size Yoda sitting behind him. That's a full level geek, man. That's good. I'm impressed.
Yeah, I got a top 50 that I'm pretty religious about, and my top three are Tree of Life, Assassination of Jesse James, and No Country for Old Men.
There is a theme there. There is definitely a theme in the filmmaking styles of those films, so I can see what Lotawana is going to be like. But will there be somebody killing people with an air gun or something like from No Country for Old Men? What is that called? Like a bolt gun or something like that?
Yeah, such the air compressor stun gun thing.
So amazing. What an amazing film. God, such a great film. Guys, it's been a pleasure talking to you, man. I'm so impressed and just awesome that you guys are doing what you're doing, man. And anytime I get someone on the show who's the first one through the door on anything, and it's so rare nowadays to be the first one through the door on anything in our business. It's like it's a tough thing to get. So I'm humbled that you came on the show to talk about it and share your adventures with us. Please let us know when you make your first million off of it. And then you're always welcome back. So thank you guys so much, man. I appreciate it.
Alex, thanks so much. This has been awesome. If anybody wants to check out the trailer.
Yes, sorry. Movie, Jesus, of course.
Yeah, no worries.
If anybody
wants to stay up to date with what we're doing, you can purchase NFTs from our website. You can watch the trailer. You can see our posters. You can stay up to date with our releases. And like I said, we're going to be releasing the movie later this fall. It's just LotawanaMovie.com. And if you just Google LotawanaMovie, probably any way you can think to spell it, you'll probably find it.
And I'll put that, I'll make sure to put that. Yeah, it's right there for anyone watching. It's not hard to spell. LOTAWANA. So I'll put that in the show notes as well. Thanks again, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex.
I want to thank Trevor and Nathan for coming on the show and sharing their NFT knowledge bombs on the tribe today. I'm really excited about NFTs, guys. I think it could be another revenue stream. I don't think it is the second coming, but I do believe that it can create revenue streams for filmmakers. And there's just something there. I don't know what it is, but sooner or later, hopefully sooner, we will crack that nut and hopefully create a controllable revenue stream from NFTs. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to gain access to Lotawana and their NFTs, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/472. And guys, next week, I announce that big, big project I have been working on that is hopefully going to help independent filmmakers around the world fund, finish, and distribute their films. I know that's a big statement, but you will see what I've been working on. So definitely keep an eye out for that. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.